Hello. This is the Pearson EdXL International GCSE English as a Second Language, Paper 2, Listening Test, Summer 2015. This test is in three parts. You will hear three extracts and will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the beginning of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all three parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen. Part 1. In this part, you will hear a man talking to students about taking a gap year after they have finished school. Listen and complete the notes. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each completed answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now, listen and answer the questions.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Golding, and I work for a group that provides information to young people who want to have a year off between school and university. This year off is also called a gap year, and there are hundreds of exciting, challenging, and valuable ways to spend it. Today, I want to look at two of the more popular types of activities that young people do on their gap year: expeditions and volunteering. Expeditions are group activities and usually last for between 6 and 15 weeks. They can be based in one or several countries and are designed to help you develop self-confidence and leadership skills. They include two phases: a conservation project and an adventure phase. For example, an 8-week expedition to northern Norway involves some time preserving plants and wildlife in the local area. This is then followed by the adventure phase, where you go mountaineering and trekking over glaciers. If you think volunteering is the thing for you, there is a wide variety of activities you can do across the world. You may work individually or in small groups, depending upon the requirements of the organisation. Sometimes you share accommodation with other volunteers, but more often than not, you stay with host families who live locally. Many volunteers say that this makes their stay very special and is far better than staying in a hostel or hotel, as you can learn about the culture and values of the country. For example, you can volunteer in Ghana for 6 months. There, you can spend your time assisting in rural schools or helping out at local orphanages with such chores as cooking, cleaning, and improving facilities. There are also opportunities to support volunteer doctors working in mobile clinics which visit remote areas of the country. Many of the voluntary programs also offer an adventure phase, which is normally done at the end of the work placement. It's important to do plenty of research before choosing which activity is the right one for you. There are a number of things that you should do before you go. One of the most important things is to get insurance, as things can happen and you may need help. You should also check that your passport is in good condition and valid for at least 6 months, and take enough money with you so that you don't run out. Another important thing is to get a good guidebook which has details about local laws and customs to avoid offending people and breaking the law, even if by accident. I'm often asked about what to take on your travels, so here's some useful advice. Every traveller will tell you to pack light, and they're right. I recommend you pack everything in a backpack if you're planning to go trekking. But if you're going to be in one place most of the time, a suitcase with wheels may be more suitable. In addition, you might like to take a small rucksack, as it can be useful if you're located in one place and travelling around from there. As for clothes, it depends on the climate. For hot climates, you'll need lightweight, loose-fitting clothes, made of cotton if possible. This is because it absorbs sweat and helps keep you cool. In cold climates, a good quality jacket is essential, with lots of layers, such as thermal vests underneath. Jumpers are too bulky, so get fleece tops instead. Make sure that your footwear is comfortable. There are several options: boots for trekking or if you need some ankle protection, and trainers, which are popular, but you must make sure that they're hard wearing enough to survive the year. Waterproof sandals are also good for day wear in hot climates and helpful in the shower and the sea. What is important is that all footwear is properly worn in before you go. It's important that you keep valuables safe, and a money belt is vital. To make sure your luggage is safe, get a padlock and chain, which can be used to attach your backpack to your bed when you're staying in a hostel, or to a travel rack in a train or bus. And finally, don't pack anything you can't afford to lose, such as jewellery.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Golding, and I work for a group that provides information to young people who want to have a year off between school and university. This year off is also called a gap year, and there are hundreds of exciting, challenging, and valuable ways to spend it. Today, I want to look at two of the more popular types of activities that young people do on their gap year: expeditions and volunteering. Expeditions are group activities and usually last for between 6 and 15 weeks. They can be based in one or several countries and are designed to help you develop self-confidence and leadership skills. They include two phases: a conservation project and an adventure phase. For example, an 8-week expedition to northern Norway involves some time preserving plants and wildlife in the local area. This is then followed by the adventure phase, where you go mountaineering and trekking over glaciers. If you think volunteering is the thing for you, there is a wide variety of activities you can do across the world. You may work individually or in small groups, depending upon the requirements of the organisation. Sometimes you share accommodation with other volunteers, but more often than not, you stay with host families who live locally. Many volunteers say that this makes their stay very special and is far better than staying in a hostel or hotel, as you can learn about the culture and values of the country. For example, you can volunteer in Ghana for 6 months. There, you can spend your time assisting in rural schools or helping out at local orphanages with such chores as cooking, cleaning, and improving facilities. There are also opportunities to support volunteer doctors working in mobile clinics which visit remote areas of the country. Many of the voluntary programs also offer an adventure phase, which is normally done at the end of the work placement. It's important to do plenty of research before choosing which activity is the right one for you. There are a number of things that you should do before you go. One of the most important things is to get insurance, as things can happen and you may need help. You should also check that your passport is in good condition and valid for at least 6 months, and take enough money with you so that you don't run out. Another important thing is to get a good guidebook which has details about local laws and customs to avoid offending people and breaking the law, even if by accident. I'm often asked about what to take on your travels, so here's some useful advice. Every traveller will tell you to pack light, and they're right. I recommend you pack everything in a backpack if you're planning to go trekking. But if you're going to be in one place most of the time, a suitcase with wheels may be more suitable. In addition, you might like to take a small rucksack, as it can be useful if you're located in one place and travelling around from there. As for clothes, it depends on the climate. For hot climates, you'll need lightweight, loose-fitting clothes, made of cotton if possible. This is because it absorbs sweat and helps keep you cool. In cold climates, a good quality jacket is essential, with lots of layers, such as thermal vests underneath. Jumpers are too bulky, so get fleece tops instead. Make sure that your footwear is comfortable. There are several options: boots for trekking or if you need some ankle protection, and trainers, which are popular, but you must make sure that they're hard wearing enough to survive the year. Waterproof sandals are also good for day wear in hot climates and helpful in the shower and the sea. What is important is that all footwear is properly worn in before you go. It's important that you keep valuables safe, and a money belt is vital. To make sure your luggage is safe, get a padlock and chain, which can be used to attach your backpack to your bed when you're staying in a hostel, or to a travel rack in a train or bus. And finally, don't pack anything you can't afford to lose, such as jewellery.
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two. Part two. In this part, you will hear an interview with a businesswoman. Listen and answer the questions. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now, listen and answer the questions.
Hello, and welcome to the Biz Podcast. I'm Sam Chapman. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome to the studio businesswoman Jess Masters, who's here to tell us about her fashion business. Welcome, Jess.
Thanks very much, Sam. I'm delighted to be here.
You have a very successful business designing and selling clothes for babies and young children. Could you tell us what motivated you to start your own business?
I really started early, in the playground at primary school. It was that I could offer something that other people didn't have, and they had something that I couldn't have. I was able to design and make dolls' clothing, and I traded it for sweets, which were things I wasn't allowed to have. My parents were very strict about that.
And this was an early sign of your future in fashion.
Yes, I knew even then that I wanted to do something in fashion. When I was a bit older, but still at secondary school, I started my own small business, making and selling dresses for friends and their families. The items were a bit unusual, but they sold well, and this experience helped me decide that I wanted to run a fashion company when I left school.
And is that what you did when you finished?
No. I realised I needed to learn the tricks of the trade, so I found work in a luxury goods shop in London. I worked really hard, and they were very good to me, even though I kept pestering them to move me to different departments every 3 months. I started as an assistant manager in the coats department and progressed up the ranks until eventually I was running the ladies' wear floor with a large team. I stayed there only 18 months, as I decided that the time was right to start my own business.
How did the idea for children's clothes come about?
Well, it was while I was staying for a time with a friend in a remote part of Scotland. She was always complaining about how difficult it was to buy clothes by mail order for her two children, and that really sparked off the idea for a new business. When I got home, I conducted market surveys and spent a lot of time talking to young parents, and I found out what they wanted. I combined their advice with my love of French traditional style children's clothing to launch my first mail order collection a few months later.
You run your company in a very particular way. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
At the heart of my business is the belief that the role everyone plays in the company is valued. We care more for the individuals who make up our teams than making huge profits. Something else that I find especially pleasing is that we've worked hard to foster a family atmosphere throughout the entire business. So we work together and we share the profits. To emphasise the point that we're all in it together, everyone eats in the same canteen. We don't have special reserved parking spaces for managers, and everyone lends a hand whenever and wherever help is needed, and that includes the warehouse during busy times.
And could you tell us something about the charity work your company is involved in?
Yes. We've found that our contributions make a real difference. BEMA is a charity in northern Zambia, and its purpose is to support farmers in the region. This is done in a number of ways. We don't simply give money. We provide education, healthcare support, fresh water, and assistance with improving agricultural methods. We also send our own staff to Africa to work with BEMA. These members of staff gain an incredible amount from the experience.
Your company went on to develop into an online store, and then more recently to open shops throughout the country. What's special about them?
We found that many customers are fed up with their current shopping experience. Large shops, full of goods, but very little service. So we opened small shops where you're personally greeted by a member of staff and helped with your shopping. We encourage them to be as child-friendly as possible with our customers, and I think that's why we have their loyalty. I know how stressful it is to go into a store with a grumpy toddler. If you're then told off by a sales assistant when that toddler touches something in the shop, it's very off-putting. We aim to take this pressure off parents.
So what do you look for in your shop staff?
It goes without saying that one of the things we look for when recruiting is staff who get on well with both parents and their children. I also don't want employees who are simply focused on making sales. In fact, I'm well known for telling our customers not to buy too much. I like to think that this will help our customers to understand the values of our company.
And what skills do you think are essential for shop work?
Nowadays, it's essential that anyone coming into retail has a good understanding of finance. Shop managers need to take responsibility for their outlet and understand when their store is making money. Buyers and designers need to understand how the business works on a financial as well as a design level.
What would you say are the real benefits of a career working in shops?
It's a shame more young people don't see it as a first choice for a career. Shop managers are well paid, and they have an extremely satisfying job. Business-minded people who like helping others will thrive in shops. They should take the plunge.
Jess Masters, Thank you for coming into the studio and talking to us today.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hello and welcome to the Biz Podcast. I'm Sam Chapman. Today I'm very pleased to welcome to the studio businesswoman Jess Masters, who's here to tell us about her fashion business. Welcome, Jess.
Thanks very much, Sam. I'm delighted to be here.
You have a very successful business designing and selling clothes for babies and young children. Could you tell us what motivated you to start your own business?
I really started early, in the playground at primary school. It was that I could offer something that other people didn't have, and they had something that I couldn't have. I was able to design and make dolls' clothing, and I traded it for sweets, which were things I wasn't allowed to have. My parents were very strict about that.
And this was an early sign of your future in fashion?
Yes. I knew even then that I wanted to do something in fashion. When I was a bit older, but still at secondary school, I started my own small business, making and selling dresses for friends and their families. The items were a bit unusual, but they sold well, and this experience helped me decide that I wanted to run a fashion company when I left school.
And is that what you did when you finished?
No. I realised I needed to learn the tricks of the trade, so I found work in a luxury goods shop in London. I worked really hard, and they were very good to me, even though I kept pestering them to move me to different departments every 3 months. I started as an assistant manager in the coats department and progressed up the ranks until eventually I was running the ladies' wear floor with a large team. I stayed there only 18 months, as I decided that the time was right to start my own business.
How did the idea for children's clothes come about?
Well, it was while I was staying for a time with a friend in a remote part of Scotland. She was always complaining about how difficult it was to buy clothes by mail order for her two children, and that really sparked off the idea for a new business. When I got home, I conducted market surveys and spent a lot of time talking to young parents, and I found out what they wanted. I combined their advice with my love of French traditional style children's clothing to launch my first mail order collection a few months later.
You run your company in a very particular way. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
At the heart of my business is the belief that the role everyone plays in the company is valued. We care more for the individuals who make up our teams than making huge profits. Something else that I find especially pleasing is that we've worked hard to foster a family atmosphere throughout the entire business. So we work together and we share the profits. To emphasise the point that we're all in it together, everyone eats in the same canteen. We don't have special reserved parking spaces for managers, and everyone lends a hand whenever and wherever help is needed, and that includes the warehouse during busy times.
And could you tell us something about the charity work your company is involved in?
Yes. We've found that our contributions make a real difference. BEMA is a charity in northern Zambia, and its purpose is to support farmers in the region. This is done in a number of ways. We don't simply give money, we provide education, healthcare support, fresh water, and assistance with improving agricultural methods. We also send our own staff to Africa to work with BEMA. These members of staff gain an incredible amount from the experience.
Your company went on to develop into an online store, and then more recently to open shops throughout the country. What's special about them?
We found that many customers are fed up with their current shopping experience. Large shops, full of goods, but very little service. So we opened small shops where you're personally greeted by a member of staff and helped with your shopping. We encourage them to be as child-friendly as possible with our customers. And I think that's why we have their loyalty. I know how stressful it is to go into a store with a grumpy toddler. If you're then told off by a sales assistant when that toddler touches something in the shop, it's very off-putting. We aim to take this pressure off parents.
So what do you look for in your shop staff?
It goes without saying that one of the things we look for when recruiting is staff who get on well with both parents and their children. I also don't want employees who are simply focused on making sales. In fact, I'm well known for telling our customers not to buy too much. I like to think that this will help our customers to understand the values of our company.
And what skills do you think are essential for shop work?
Nowadays, it's essential that anyone coming into retail has a good understanding of finance. Shop managers need to take responsibility for their outlet and understand when their store is making money. Buyers and designers need to understand how the business works on a financial as well as a design level.
What would you say are the real benefits of a career working in shops?
It's a shame more young people don't see it as a first choice for a career. Shop managers are well paid and they have an extremely satisfying job. Business-minded people who like helping others will thrive in shops. They should take the plunge.
Jess Masters, thank you for coming into the studio and talking to us today.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear an extract from a radio program on the history of lunch. Listen and complete the sentences. Write no more than three words for each answer. One mark will be awarded for each answer. First, you have 1 minute to read the questions. Now, listen and answer the questions.
For many of us who live in towns and cities, lunch is usually eaten in a bit of a rush. It's a time in the middle of our working day when we top up our energy levels to get through the rest of the day. If we look back over the last 500 years, we can see that our eating patterns have changed quite considerably. 500 years ago, during the medieval era in Europe, people ate all their meals during the hours of daylight. They got up with the sun and went to bed when it set. The main meal was taken in the middle of the working day, at about 10 a.m., after most people had done 5 hours of work. It wasn't called lunch, but dinner, and usually consisted of a thick vegetable soup, boiled meat of some sort, fruit and bread. Fish was also popular. Most people worked on the land, so they usually ate dinner at home or out in the fields if it was fine. This was the pattern for the next few hundred years. By the 1700s, the way people earned their living was changing, and as more of them lived in cities, new work patterns were emerging. The gap between breakfast and the main meal was getting wider. Now, dinner was eaten at around 3 p.m. This was due not only to new forms of employment, but also to the fact that most people had access to more effective artificial lighting to illuminate their homes. This meant that people tended to stay up later after sunset. The idea of lunch was born to bridge the gap between breakfast and dinner, and it took the form of a snack, consisting usually of cold meats and salads. The 1800s was a period of enormous change in Europe. Called the Industrial Revolution, it caused mass migration to cities, where people found work mostly in factories. As the economy became increasingly based on industry rather than agriculture, not as many people were able to grow their own food, and this radically affected how they ate their meals. Most people couldn't get home in the middle of the day, as the distance between home and work had increased. In consequence, the main meal of the day moved to the evening. The poorest factory workers often lived in houses without kitchens, and they also had little time to prepare proper meals. They relied on street sellers for cheap fast food, such as baked potatoes and meat pies. Slightly wealthier workers, such as factory foremen, brought their lunch to work in a tin bucket with a lid, or wrapped in paper. And those who were lucky enough to afford it had lunch in taverns, chop houses, or similar eating houses. Around the 1850s, it became fashionable for wealthy women to use lunch as an occasion to entertain friends at home. By then, most working men ate lunch out, so women could show hospitality to their female friends at little expense. Dishes would be dainty rather than substantial, and as the women ate lunch without removing their jackets or hats, it was important that food was easy to handle. The meal was eaten in the dining room, and the table was simply laid. The sandwich became a popular item to have for lunch during the 1800s. It was ideal, as it was portable, did not need cutlery, and could be eaten very quickly. Although it had been invented 100 years earlier, it was during the 1800s that recipe books appeared with ideas for a variety of fillings. Interestingly, at the time they recommended sandwich fillings that were suitable for men, such as meat, and ones suitable for women, such as cream cheese. As more and more people had to rely on street food to feed themselves, there was a great deal of anxiety about the health of the British population by the 1900s. Many young men who were examined at the time were small or undernourished. In 1906, the government responded with a law which allowed school meals to be offered to pupils. In an effort to promote the importance of a proper, balanced lunch, it was free for the poorest children. The motive was also practical because hungry children cannot learn. This law changed the lives of millions and was a reminder that a substantial meal in the middle of the day pays dividends. But it would seem that this message is getting lost as our work patterns change yet again. It may be called a lunch hour, but for many of today's office workers, a 60-minute break to eat their meal is a thing of the past. For example, over half of British workers spend just 20 minutes having lunch each day. Hectic lifestyles, longer working hours, and an increasingly 24/7 lifestyle have all been blamed for the decline in this traditional mealtime, as people are increasingly forced to eat on the go. About 54% of office workers regularly have lunch at their desks, and this pattern is repeated across much of the Western world. Many workers feel that they are pressured to skip lunch as a sign that they are hard-working employees. But experts are now so concerned about the lack of a lunch break, they're considering making them compulsory. It seems that eating a fresh and filling lunch keeps energy levels up, and this in turn can help people be more productive and enjoy their work more. Perhaps it's time to consider revisiting the eating patterns of the past.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
For many of us who live in towns and cities, lunch is usually eaten in a bit of a rush. It's a time in the middle of our working day when we top up our energy levels to get through the rest of the day. If we look back over the last 500 years, we can see that our eating patterns have changed quite considerably. 500 years ago, during the medieval era in Europe, people ate all their meals during the hours of daylight. They got up with the sun and went to bed when it set. The main meal was taken in the middle of the working day, at about 10 a.m., after most people had done 5 hours of work. It wasn't called lunch, but dinner, and usually consisted of a thick vegetable soup, boiled meat of some sort, fruit, and bread. Fish was also popular. Most people worked on the land, so they usually ate dinner at home or out in the fields if it was fine. This was the pattern for the next few hundred years. By the 1700s, the way people earned their living was changing, and as more of them lived in cities, new work patterns were emerging. The gap between breakfast and the main meal was getting wider. Now, dinner was eaten at around 3 p.m. This was due not only to new forms of employment, but also to the fact that most people had access to more effective artificial lighting to illuminate their homes. This meant that people tended to stay up later after sunset. The idea of lunch was born to bridge the gap between breakfast and dinner, and it took the form of a snack, consisting usually of cold meats and salads. The 1800s was a period of enormous change in Europe. Called the Industrial Revolution, it caused mass migration to cities, where people found work mostly in factories. As the economy became increasingly based on industry rather than agriculture, not as many people were able to grow their own food, and this radically affected how they ate their meals. Most people couldn't get home in the middle of the day, as the distance between home and work had increased. In consequence, the main meal of the day moved to the evening. The poorest factory workers often lived in houses without kitchens, and they also had little time to prepare proper meals. They relied on street sellers for cheap, fast food, such as baked potatoes and meat pies. Slightly wealthier workers, such as factory foremen, brought their lunch to work in a tin bucket with a lid, or wrapped in paper. And those who were lucky enough to afford it had lunch in taverns, chop houses, or similar eating houses. Around the 1850s, it became fashionable for wealthy women to use lunch as an occasion to entertain friends at home. By then, most working men ate lunch out, so women could show hospitality to their female friends at little expense. Dishes would be dainty rather than substantial, and as the women ate lunch without removing their jackets or hats, it was important that food was easy to handle. The meal was eaten in the dining room, and the table was simply laid. The sandwich became a popular item to have for lunch during the 1800s. It was ideal, as it was portable, did not need cutlery, and could be eaten very quickly. Although it had been invented 100 years earlier, it was during the 1800s that recipe books appeared with ideas for a variety of fillings. Interestingly, at the time they recommended sandwich fillings that were suitable for men, such as meat, and ones suitable for women, such as cream cheese. As more and more people had to rely on street food to feed themselves, there was a great deal of anxiety about the health of the British population by the 1900s. Many young men who were examined at the time were small or undernourished. In 1906, the government responded with a law which allowed school meals to be offered to pupils. In an effort to promote the importance of a proper, balanced lunch, it was free for the poorest children. The motive was also practical because hungry children cannot learn. This law changed the lives of millions and was a reminder that a substantial meal in the middle of the day pays dividends. But it would seem that this message is getting lost as our work patterns change yet again. It may be called a lunch hour, but for many of today's office workers, a 60-minute break to eat their meal is a thing of the past. For example, over half of British workers spend just 20 minutes having lunch each day. Hectic lifestyles, longer working hours, and an increasingly 24/7 lifestyle have all been blamed for the decline in this traditional mealtime, as people are increasingly forced to eat on the go. About 54% of office workers regularly have lunch at their desks, and this pattern is repeated across much of the Western world. Many workers feel that they are pressured to skip lunch as a sign that they are hard-working employees. But experts are now so concerned about the lack of a lunch break, they're considering making them compulsory. It seems that eating a fresh and filling lunch keeps energy levels up, and this in turn can help people be more productive and enjoy their work more. Perhaps it's time to consider revisiting the eating patterns of the past.
That's the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklets to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.